Succession number 28359, Reel 7.
Are we on yet? I'm going to say, if I just...
Roy Gibbs, Reel 7. Roy, we were just... You just come to the end of the of what was called Operation Iceberg, the operations against the Sakishima Islands and Formosa.
We arrived back in Sydney, Australia, on the 1st of June. A rather battered British Pacific fleet, and of course we were very short of having lost a great number of our aircraft. We were rather short of aircraft and crews. All the remaining air crews were flown off to a newly constructed air station at Schofield, which was a small suburb just outside Sydney. It suited us down to the ground because we could get a train in every night into Sydney itself, which gave us a good break. But during the day, we were busy forming up with new aircraft, new crews, training new crews. A percentage of the old squadron members or crews were sent off, relieved by new people, so the new people, we had to help break the new people in. Those that were lucky of us, lucky to stay with it, or unlucky as the case may be, were put into the senior positions of flight leaders and flying with the CO of the squadron. You've got your mic off, by the way.
Okay, there you go.
We were briefed that we were going to become Task Force 37 of the American Third Fleet off Japan, and obviously our targets were going to be on the mainland of Japan from now on. The first strike took place on the 24th of July, and that was bombing a Japanese carrier in Shido 1 harbour in the Inland Sea. At this stage, I can say we successfully sank it. From then on, we had carrying out the same type of strikes as we were doing in Sakishima, with a difference that they were on mainland Japanese targets, and the defences, therefore, were considerably more hairy than they were in Sakishima. The flak was much greater.
Can I just ask, Roy, this is July 1945.
Yep.
You know that there is victory in Europe. How were you and your friends feeling at that time when you realised that the war was over in Europe and you were still having to continue to fight?
Well, I think I can speak for everyone at the time. I should say that they were pleased for their friends and families, that everything was okay for them back home. There was a certain amount of resentment about the fact that people seemed to be making a big celebration of it, which we thought was rather unfair, as we were up to our eyes still fighting and flying. But it was a passing thought. There was a job to be done. Couldn't do very much about it anyway. Similarly, when we heard that they were talking about holding elections, we thought this was rather unfair as well, until they might at least have waited till we got home. But at that stage, of course, we didn't know when we were going to get home. Japan had to be defeated, and I think it wasn't a job that many of us looked forward to. We knew we were going to meet tremendous opposition.
Okay, so you carried on with the operations.
Yep, we were striking. The difference was that, there was a lot of heavy opposition. We were striking things like the shipping, installations, Japanese airfields. And this went on steadily until eventually were told that two areas were going to be no-go areas. We shouldn't go near them. That, of course, was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. From a distance while we were operating, whilst we couldn't see the actual areas, we could see the terrible, appalling smoke clouds and what looked like devastation in the distance. And we were told that atom bombs had been dropped on Japan, and there was hope that this was going to have the effect of finishing the war.
And at this time, you knew what... Did it have to be explained to you what an atom bomb was? Had you any idea what they were?
Well, our intelligence team told us what was going on and what they were, and what it was unheard of course in those days, but they explained what it was and the terrible effects of it and the damage it had done. So we continued to attack. We were slowly beating down the opposition. The Japanese got weaker and weaker, and that could have been the last straw was the dropping of the atom bomb. I think one of the things that really upset us was the very last day, the 15th of August. At this time, we could put 1,000 aircraft, together with the Americans, could put 1,000 aircraft in the air over Japan, which is quite something from naval-based aircraft, from ships. But it was decided that our other three carriers, war was almost over, and our other three carriers would be withdrawn with their escorts, and we would stay on the Indefatigable as a token gesture with our own escorts and carry out till the end, till actually the peace was declared. I heard him referred to as some highly placed idiot, decided on the 15th of August that we would make a strike on Tokyo. We only had something like six dive bombers left. I think we had six dive bombers, about half a dozen C-5s, and about three Firefly. And they decided they would raid Tokyo over these. And of course, while they were on their way out, the ceasefire was declared. The Japanese weren't prepared to accept it at that stage, and they bounced our chaps very, very heavily. And they did fight their way back with very heavy losses, which wasn't a very popular thing. We weren't very happy with the powers that be over that. Anyway, the ceasefire had struck, and I think one amusing thing out of this was that just after the ceasefire struck, as a ceasefire was called, our skipper came on the tannoy on the ship and said, the ceasefire has been called from 12 o'clock today. Any Japanese aircraft approaching the fleet would be shot down in a friendly fashion. All sorts of rumours were then going round. The air crews were going to be sent ashore as crews to help with the taking over of the Japanese. We were going to be part of the peacekeeping force. All false, of course, just pure rumour. Suddenly, the thing was that the sea obviously decided to take a hand in it, and we hit a terrible typhoon, which was so bad that, in fact, I think it's the worst thing I've ever seen at sea. It was so powerful that our forward lift on the carrier, in spite of the fact being held in place hydraulically, was smashed down and actually bent. But we were very fortunate because the American carrier, the Wasp, drew alongside us after the typhoon with their wooden flight decks. They had 30 foot of their flight deck hanging over the forward end where it had been smashed down. Their captain got on the horn, as we used to call it, to our chap and said, "How did you weather the typhoon?" Our skipper, well known for his sense of humour, called back, "What typhoon?" Anyway, there we were. Eventually, we went into Tokyo Harbour. Present for the signing, just to be present for the signing of the peace. The Duke of York came up from Sydney with our overall admiral in charge, Bruce Fraser. Not very popular because they hadn't been outside Sydney through the whole of the campaign. But yeah, it's one of those things.
Roy, how did you feel then when you actually... The war has ended. You've carried out all these operations against the Japanese, and there you are on a British carrier sailing right into Tokyo Harbour.
Well, obviously a slight feeling of elation. A lot of sorrow because we in fact lost a great number of our aircraft, although what we did was very effective. We lost 141 aircraft during that part of the campaign, just attacking the Japanese mainland, and of course a number of air crews went with them. So a certain amount of sorrow for our comrades that weren't going to make it. A lot of speculation, when were we going home? No one told us. We spent a bit of time flying off and dropping stuff to a prisoner of war camp we found, although we were getting pretty short of supplies ourselves. Everybody rallied round and raided their saved up goodies that they'd been keeping for a rainy day, tots of rum, illegal rum I might add, bars of chocolate, things that they'd, you know, we kept stored in our mess for a rainy day. They raided the ship's naffy, took everything was possible. We took out and dropped to the prisoner of war camp at Yakachi 1. And then we were told we were preparing back to Sydney. In terms of personal feelings, sorry.
Ken, did you actually take part in this drop on the prisoner of war camp?
Yeah.
So you were actually parachuting supplies to the prisoners?
Yeah, we made up parachute drops. So they made them up from sort of ammunition cases, anything we could make, that, you know, our crews could make up for them. Put parachutes on them. It's one of the most pleasant job of the war, I think.
And could you see the men in the prison?
They were waving to us, and subsequently after the war, one of them wrote to one of our observers and said, you know, how grateful they were to see us, grateful for what we dropped. And we did invite him subsequently post-war to one of our ship's reunions, but unfortunately the rigors he'd been through in the Japanese prisoner of war camp, he never made it because the poor chap died before he could come and see us. So you know, a lot of mixed feelings about the whole thing. The journey back to Australia was not pleasant. Royal Navy discipline began to assert itself. Bit by bit, we lost our aircrew privileges. We were called upon to work ship, which we weren't very happy about. We thought at least we'd earned a rest.
So what sort of duties were you having to do now to work? What was work ship?
Duty PO in charge of the various work parties, going round, waking the blokes up, reveille, and turning about their hammocks, and in charge of the working parties, cleaning out the toilets and all that sort of thing. We just felt we'd earned a bit of a rest. By the time we got to Sydney, all our privileges had been withdrawn. The only thing was we were sent immediately off the ship to a nearby transit camp they formed in Australia, just outside Sydney, called HMS Golden Hind. There we found it was mainly full of people who'd been shipped out there, replacements for the losses they thought we were going to have in Japan. So they were waiting to be sent somewhere. They refilled our old ship with all brand new air crews from the UK, and we had a little chuckle to ourselves because these brand new air crews and brand new aircraft were then sent on a victory tour around Australia, New Zealand, etc. And we thought, well, that's great, yeah. We managed to dodge doing very much work in HMS Golden Hind. We found that we formed ourselves into a squad, and one of our chief POs walked beside us with a clipboard. We could manage to dodge doing anything until it came time to go ashore to Sydney. But
so you even just, the... You were just giving the impression that you were doing something.
Giving the impression we were doing something. It didn't go on for very long, thank goodness, because even the flesh pots of Sydney were getting a bit too much. We just wanted to get home. Eventually, we were put on this very fast... it was a freezer ship, the Dominion Monarch. It was taking frozen fruit, for bringing frozen fruit back to England. And there was ourselves, a large number of Japanese prisoners of war who were in a dreadful state, poor chaps. And for some peculiar reason, 500 Australian war brides. Odd mixture. Interesting journey home, because we were not allowed to fraternise anyway. It was very heavily laid down. But we did manage to talk to them occasionally. It made the journey a little bit lighter. And
What about the prisoners of war? Did you presumably you mixed with them? And
oh yeah, I mean we could mix with them and chat with them, but they were so bad. I mean they were like walking skeletons. It was.
Was this the first time you were aware of how the Japanese treated prisoners, or did you all know about that anyway?
Oh, I think we knew about it because we had a very good intelligence team on board. And they did keep us extremely well briefed what was going on. But you know, you can be made aware of it when you actually see it. You know, walking skeletons, well, people have probably seen it post-war. I mean, it's a dreadful sight. Before you could say knife, we were through the Med and sailing up the Solent to Southampton. And there, I must have a little moan here, because there we were greeted by our grateful government, where both ourselves and the prisoners of war were heavily turned over by the customs officers. What the hell they thought we had, no one ever knew. It got very nasty, it got very close to, we started to abuse them, they threatened us with arrest. It got very near to fisticuffs in one or two occasions.
So they were actually searching the prisoners of war?
They were turning the prisoner of war's bags out on the table. That's what we were prepared to accept it ourselves, but not for them. In fact, some of the chaps who were still on board started pelting the customs officers with anything they could lay their hands on. We thought, well, this is a taste of what... yeah, the war had been over a long while as far as people back home were concerned. We were told there'd be no shore leave, but we would go home on immediate and indefinite leave the following day. I must be honest and say we did get out that night. We found that the Admiralty Marine Police on guard at the gate were quite susceptible to the odd couple of packets of fags, so let us go ashore. So we went ashore and had a good old drink in an English pub. I went straight home on leave. Found that nobody wanted to know much about the Japanese war. It was all over as far as they were concerned. It had been over for some time. Most of your pals were still away. Managed to see my girlfriend, who's now my wife, has been for many years. So that was nice, and see my folks. But, you know, a bit appalled at the damage that was being done in London by the German bombing and rockets and things.
So that was still very evident, was it?
Yeah. And then suddenly I got a telegram to join a Firefly fighter bomber squadron in a place called Cullen, which is near Abingdon, in Oxfordshire. When I arrived there, I found that all the officer air crew were newly passed out, very pompous, very aware of their wings. All my own kind tags were straight off course, very keen to fly. There's only one other chap that was off my squadron, a bloke called Bob Vargason, and we decided that as they were keen to fly, we wouldn't try and stop them. We'd let them do all the flying for us, and we'd do the duties in the control tower and so on.
So you felt as though by this time that you'd done enough flying.
Safety. Wouldn't get out in one piece if you survived this long. I think in total I'd actually done 67 operations. I'd been shot down twice and I was still in one piece, and I wanted to stay that way. So, you know, I think we were there till about the January. In January I suddenly got my Dinopti mob number came up. And,
so this was January 1946?
January 1946, yeah. We found out afterwards, I mean, lots of chaps were, didn't come up till long after, your army blokes and RAF chaps. For some reason, the Admiralty decided we were an expensive item. They didn't quite know what to do with us, so they chucked us out, which was very nice for us. I must admit, I drank far too much rum in the mess at lunchtime, probably a few beers on top. I arrived home at my father's house. I don't quite know how. I had a label tied around my neck, which read, "IMD mobbed. Please put me out the train at Didcot. Didcot, please put me in a train to Paddington. Paddington, please put me in a taxi to 53 Green Lanes, which is my father's house." And I came out of my drunken stupor to see my father paying the cab off and escorting me indoors, and that was the end of my war.
How long had it been since you'd seen your father?
About a year to 18 months, I suppose.
Right. And he knew that what you were doing, that you were in the thick of this war in the East.
Because I spent very little time in England. I did my flying training in Canada. And after a few months back here, I was straight on to the carrier and out East. So I hadn't spent a lot of time in the UK. In fact, I think I'm one of the few chaps that didn't qualify for a defence medal. I was never in England long enough to qualify for it.
Roy Gibbs, Reel 8.
Well, once demobbed and duly kitted out with my new uniform, the civvies handed out to all returning servicemen, I thought, well, I'm going to have to do something. I've got 57 days demobilisation leave, I think. So I rang up my old boss at the Daily Express and said, I'm home, better come up and see me. My boss was a well-known character in Fleet Street in the old days. His name was Bill Needham. He was the second largest voting shareholder, I think, outside the Beaverbrook family in the Express newspapers. A man of very large stature, always wore a monocle screwed in his right eye and a carnation in his left lapel. And I reported myself at the office, and his secretary said, "Well, you want to see you, go straight in." So I looked up. I was still in uniform. His first comment was, "Oh, Gibbs, so you've covered yourself in glory." It was such a different environment. All I could think to say was, "Yes, sir." In retrospect, that was a bit of a big-headed thing to do. And he had a chat and said, "How long you've got?" He said, "I want you to go away and enjoy that. Don't think about work. Just let me know when you want to come back." I said, "Well, any idea what I'm going to do?" He said, "Oh, I've got just the thing for you." He said, "I want you to take over the gardening feature." And this would include, he said, "You know, you've heard of Adam the Gardener." Adam the Gardener, for those people who don't know, was an antiquated old chap who wore gaiters and a hat and was always telling people how to run their allotments during the war in cartoon strip form. I immediately said to him, "But sir, I know nothing about gardening." And his parting shot was, "Well, you better bloody well find out then." And I thought, well, Sippy Street ain't going to be much different from the Fleet Arm after all. I went away to spend my leave, but suddenly leave was boring. There was nobody to spend it with. My girlfriend was at work during the day. Ran into an old pal of mine who had been a Fleet Arm pilot. He was on demob leave. And so I found somewhere where we could do some work. And British drug houses were taking on people to do sort of clerking, totting up invoices. So we did 2 or 3 weeks of that. Which didn't really turn us on either.
Then I thought, that was what, British?
British drug houses.
They
were a very big company at the time. They used to supply all sorts of drugs. So their big thing was Virol for kiddie winkies. And I think they actually invented and produced codeine eventually. Mm-hmm. They're a very big drug company situated in North London. They probably don't exist anymore, or been taken over. But yeah, just a sort of, we were expected to tot out these invoices and add up figures and things. I suppose it got us back used to civilian life. Had a bit of a disagreement with my father. He felt that I shouldn't go back to the Daily Express. He thought the time had come for me to join the family firm. I didn't fancy being a builder very much, and I knew that we probably wouldn't see eye to eye because, to my mind, he was so old-fashioned in his ways. He probably knew more about building and I never learned in my life. But I did agree that I would go out and work for him for 2 or 3 weeks just to fill in my time, for which he would pay me, of course. It really didn't suit me. I didn't like climbing up ladders. I didn't like painting. And I wanted to know why he wasn't going for the new techniques like spray painting, while everything was still being done with a brush. And it was obvious that even if we went to work in the firm, we weren't going to see eye to eye. And he insisted that I would have to start at the bottom and become a tradesman. And I was already a tradesman in Fleet Street. So, yeah, nothing came of that. I went back and joined the Daily Express as the gardening feature man on the Daily and Sunday Express. All a bit vague now. I remember a lot of my time was spent going to see Dutch bulb merchants and nurserymen. Incredible thing was, in those days, nobody gave you a car and nobody had a car very much. So if you were to call on a nurseryman somewhere way down the wilds of Essex, they rarely lived miles from anywhere. You went by train, bus, and Shanks's pony. which I don't think many people in Fleet Street were used to. I did that for, a couple of years. It's interesting. Break back into Fleet Street. I'd found out where all the pubs and clubs were now. And,
and what about your former colleagues on Fleet Street and your friends from the neighbourhood where you grew up? Presumably they'd all had different stories from the war as well. You spent time catching up with them?
Not immediately. I think everybody was trying to re-establish themselves in Civvy Street. It wasn't until 1947. Actually, four of our old Slagamist air gunners met for a drink. They found where each other were, and they met for a drink in, I think they did the Rainbow Tavern in Fleet Street was their first meeting place, strangely enough. And I didn't know about this at the time, and they decided they would start an association.